Okay, folks, I think we're all sorted with the drinks again now, so we can get back underway. I see we're sorted with the ice cream sundaes as well, Richard. That looks absolutely amazing. We should get somebody to take a photograph and put it on the internet. Excellent. Good. Excellent. Yes, so we have the finest ice cream sundaes at Bristol Confringe. The other thing that I'm reminded to tell you all about, just in case you didn't know, is that the Hugo nominations for this year are now out. There has been a little bit of fuss on the internet about them, but in amongst all the awfulness, there's also another nomination for Emmett and Pete Newman for the Tea and Jeopardy podcast. So those of you who are inclined to get involved in voting, you know, we could bring a Hugo back to Bristol, which would be cool. Anybody wanting to know any more information about that, come and talk to me afterwards. In the meantime, we need to get back with the readings, and kicking us off is going to be Justin.
Good evening, I'm Justin Newland. This is a story called The Fall of Abbot's Lee. All year long, the famine endured, but the Lord had blessed our Abbey of St. Augustine with enough vegetables for a watery stew. Beads of sweat poured from under my black tunic as I served the townsfolk, who sat like beanstalks in the refectory. They licked their bowls clean, but their hollow eyes and sunken cheeks told us they yearned for more. That was when I first capped eyes on the fool. The townsfolk mocked his cack-handed body, and he slunk back to his village. That evening, the dean told us of a disease that scythed people like hay at harvest time. For now, he said, it lay across the seas, yet he warned the destroyer is coming. Before I joined the mendicant friars, I was an apprentice physic, so the dean dispatched me and my lad to care for the villagers of Clifftown. The next day was the Feast of the Assumption. After celebrating Vespers in St. Andrew's, we walked past the stocks to the tavern atop St. Vincent's Rock and supped warm ale. In the pale evening light, a couple of fork-tailed swallows flew with grace between the gaping jaws of the gorge. In the river below was a ship, its sails filled with the Atlantic westerlies, jibing up the river to Bristow docks from far Genoa or Venice. Was this the craft, I thought, from which the stevedores would discharge the angel of death? On t'other side of the gorge was Abbot's Lee, where I first saw the fool again, sat on a stone seat, rocking back and forth. Heads bowed, a score of villagers slouched past him onto the cemetery. A gust of wind blew their cries of bereavement across the mouth of the gorge. After the requiem, the fool stood upon the seat, shouting, 50! What meanest thou? I yelled. But the wind blew the question back in my face. The fool means nothing, my lab joked, because a fool's nothing begets nothing. We laughed, yet I was none the wiser for the fool's 50. After prime the next day, I was called to old Mother Shipton's. She had raw swellings like red balloons in the neck, groin and the pits of her arms. I lanced them with a tip of a hen's feather. I winced at the sight of the thick black blood that exuded from the buboes and grimaced at the smell as vile as Lucifer himself. Before sunset, old mother died in agony. As the sun burnt the evening sky, I gazed, frozen in grief, across the unforgiving crags of St. Vincent's Rock. I heard his voice drift across the void. 55, he shouted. Then I knew his foolish meaning. That day, 5 had been assumed up to heaven from Abbot's Lee. I unfurled my rosary and thrice repeated the Marian benediction and prayed, please God, take this blessed fool. Daily I grew acquainted with this wretched malady. The buboes burst in the villages like corn poppies blown in the wind, spraying death to all corners, killing kith and kin, swire and villain, young and old. By Michaelmas, our numbers in Clifftown had dwindled to no more than the days in the month of September. With no more physic for the dying, I uttered the extreme unction over their hapless souls, then called the warden to dispose of their racket bodies in his tumbrel. By All Hallows, a month later, the swallows had gone, and as had my lad. We few struggled to break the frost-laden earth with wooden spades, but finally we laid him to rest in the last vacant grave in the cemetery. After matins the following day, I collected the last victims in the tumbrel and coaxed the stubborn mule past the tall grass in the main street, past the rotting stocks and the deserted tavern. I dressed the naked dead in handfuls of lime and covered the plague pit with sods. My prayers went heavenward. My tears bled into the callous earth. I was the last in Clifftown to succumb. With rope betwixt my teeth, I lanced a fetid pustule in my neck with a hen's feather until it leaked pus all over the windswept leaves and blackness overtook my eyes. I awoke filled with dread. Who would consign my body to consecrated ground? From the lip of the gorge, I peered into the abyss, tempted by the appeal of a quick end. A blue, dark raven alighted on a nearby rock and strutted up and down, cronking, bending its head as if berating my weakness. Then I remembered. A solitary raven had guarded St. Vincent's tortured body. The Lord had sent this bird to save me from falling into corruption. Then I heard the fool's voice again. A shroud of silence descended. I witnessed him spring off the stone seat, click his heels together in midair and shout, "One!" As he walked away, I pondered hard what meaneth the God who is merciful to fools.
That was so very nearly brilliantly timed. Okay, I guess it's me next then. What we have here is the first part of a story that I was hoping I would be able to submit to the Long Hidden anthology, but the characters kind of got away from me and wanted a lot more space than the submission guidelines allowed, so I didn't manage to get it submitted there, but I will read, you know, a few hundred words for you now. For fairly obvious reasons, this story is called Gunpowder, Treason and Plot. "Fair King, attend and mark! I do hear the morning lark," said Henry Condell, who was taking the part of Robin Goodfellow. Richard Burbage, as Oberon, was about to reply when a most unlark-like noise rent the air. "I've heard cannon fired in celebration at the king's coronation." Yet that was but a whisper compared to the sound that ripped through London that November morning. When I learned how far away I had been from its source, I felt sure that those closer to it would have had their ears blown out, had they not been killed. We abandoned our rehearsals and rushed out of the theatre onto the banks of the Thames. To the west, towards Westminster, a huge pall of smoke was rising. Even at this distance, flames could be seen licking the sky. Had Satan himself fallen to earth in the city, he could not have made a more baleful sight. "'Tis Parliament, I fear," said Burbage. "The King was due to open a new session this morning. Whatever can have befallen it?" "Some damnable Catholic plot, if you ask me," replied Condell. Soon everyone was talking at once, speculating on what might have befallen our sponsor, and who might be responsible for this outrage. The Spanish, French and Venetians all fell under suspicion. A throng of Londoners had gathered around us, and it became hard to hear oneself think. Yet the fate of the King was uppermost in everyone's mind. "Gentlemen, quiet, if you please!" If there was one voice that could stop us all in our tracks, it was that of our company's leader. All of our ears were well tuned to the voice of Will Shakespeare. As was his wont, he put practical matters to the fore. "Whether the king be alive or dead, that matter is in God's hands. There's nothing we can do on that score. One thing we can save, however, is London. If that fire spreads, the city will be burned, and our theatre along with it. Fetch buckets and follow me." "Will speaks truly," I said. "We must make all haste." "Not in those skirts, you won't," muttered Condell, to general merriment. He was right. I'd been selected to play the role of Titania, Queen of Fairy. I wasn't going to be running anywhere in her costume. "Catch up with us as you can, Dawkins," yelled Shakespeare over his shoulder as he led the company off westwards. "Time waits for no man today, fairy queen or no." The fate of the king was still in my mind as I hustled back into the Globe to change clothes. Our new Scottish monarch had been a good patron to the company and had even had us play for him at Hampton Court. He'd commented me on my Ophelia. This pleased Will no end, for he thought Hamlet one of his finest works, but was concerned that the madwoman's antics might offend our deeply religious king. It's one thing to imagine a monarch dying, quite another when that man has shaken you by the hand. Moreover, As Kingsmen, we were not just specially favoured players. We were a vehicle for royal propaganda. Whoever replaced King James on the throne, the chances were he would not be friendly to a royal favourite like Will. Excuse me, miss. I was jolted out of my reverie by a handsome young man. By the look of his physique and the sword balanced carelessly on his hip, he was probably a soldier of some sort. Perhaps a bodyguard to a nobleman, for he was dressed well and his beard neatly trimmed. My apologies, good sir, I responded, but I'm on an urgent errand. All of London must tend to the flames, lest the city be burned. Well, that much I can see, he responded, for the fire is visible from here. Yet my need is even more urgent. If your king is dead, all of my country may be lost. I need your aid, fair maid. I could not for the life of me figure what he meant. His accent was foreign to me, but he spoke English well enough. I'd met all sorts of foreigners in the city, from Russians to Greeks and Turks to Moors, and none of them spoke English the way he did. Still, I was a sucker for anyone who took me for a girl, especially one as handsome as this fellow. I'm in need, mistress, of a lady to perform a role. I've seen you on stage at this theatre, and you're just the person I require. My, he must be from far off if he did not know that the parts of women in plays were taken by young men like me. The church refused to allow actual women on stage. Not that I was complaining. The chance to comport myself as a woman was a dream come true. As soon as I was old enough to consider the possibility, I'd thrown myself into learning all I could of stagecraft, that I might have such an opportunity. Yet it seems I must reveal myself to this handsome foreigner. You're seeking a lady, sir, then I fear you may be disappointed. You seem unaccustomed to the habits of London players. Ah, come on, girl. I saw you play Juliet the other week. There's not a jot of male performance in you. I do not understand your words, sir, but as to my performance, it's been commented on favourably by King James himself. God rest his soul if he be dead, as I fear we must suspect. Alrighty, how's the translation coming along? Okay, just give you a couple more minutes then. Tom, would you like to finish the shell story? Because that should be fairly quick.
Yes. So, where we'd left my six-year-old self with Peter being turned to sand and being sucked into the shell. I'm not sure how long I stood there, but before I knew it, my mother and Rob had returned with the dog and wanted to know what I was doing. Peter, I stammered, unable to get the words out. He got sucked into the shell. Who's Peter? My mother asked. My brother, I said. I'm your brother, stupid, said Rob, giving me a punch on the arm. Our other brother, idiot, I said, pushing him as I burst into tears. Our mother split us apart and took us back to the car. It soon became clear that no one else remembered Peter, and I was the only one who did. It was tough for a while. My parents became increasingly worried about my behaviour. I would act out at school. I even got into a few fights because of it, and I got sent to therapy. I told them everything that happened, but they just said I invented him to act as a father figure, as my dad worked abroad a lot. Well, because no one believed me, I became quite insular and quiet. There was no one to talk to. Well, there was one. Peter. I kept the shell, you see. I still have it after all these years, and I hear him talk to me sometimes, and he's fine now and then. No one else can hear him, but he has Shelley, and he seems okay. They're fine in their own way, but they're getting lonely in the shell, just the two of them. They want more company, you see. Sometimes I'm tempted to join them, but I know I can't just disappear. There's so much I want to do, so much I want to see, so much of the world to experience. Maybe one day, though. But sometimes I wonder, what if I don't have to? What if I introduce someone else to the show?
Okay, and our final story of the evening, just while you're getting up there, I think the Polish National Convention, PIRCON, is taking place this coming weekend. And I know Joe and Gay Haldeman are going out there for it, but also I think one of their guests of honour is Jasper Ford, who's going to be our guest of honour at BristolCon this year. So people in Poland, if you're listening to this, please don't break Jasper. We need him back in one piece.
Okay, Of course, the rules are rules, so 5 minutes. Hopefully there will be some interesting cliffhanger and I can carry on. If not, that'll be fine, because probably later it gets harder. One more thing. In advance, big sorry for all the mistakes, as I'm basically writing not to be famous or whatever, or be professional, just to practice my writing skills. So, all right, that's the story. It's that kicks off something bigger. Right, it's called Tutti Frutti di Nightmare. Hope you're gonna like it. I was sitting on the toilet, but not for obvious reasons, as the toilet was closed. I had nothing but underwear and t-shirt. I was hunched and hiding my face in hands. Tap seemed to pour down the same amount of water as rain behind the gloomy window. Of course, it was cold, and I was cold, but back then I didn't realize it. I barely could realize anything, really. I knew I have to leave in approximately 15 minutes in order to not get late for work. Otherwise, I would get a verbal whiplash, my hours will be cut, or they will simply throw me up onto my ugly snort just to replace me with other keen idiot ready to die for peanuts. Well, I don't care, I didn't care, and I'm not going to. This is job, not work, so... Sweet. I'm crazy. I'm nuts. I lost my marbles, I whispered. I'm paranoid. How am I supposed to help myself? I just can't believe this. Excuse me, sir, but let me be there to ask, please. What exactly would you like to believe in? Said the kind voice, and I could swear something moved really close, like it was making itself comfortable. I spread my fingers wide for a moment just to peek, but the bathroom was small, and there wasn't absolutely no one but me. I exhaled and put my fingers back together. I could feel my words on my forehead bouncing back from my hands, and whispers were sinister and scary. Hello, excuse me. Could I ask you, please? It is so interesting, perhaps. I could swear the voice was warm and cool at the same time, like a certain kind of wind. I smelled lime and chocolate, expensive one. It was a good voice. I decided to ignore it. There's nobody in this bathroom but me. It's not in the tub, not under the tub. Rats don't speak. Spiders don't speak even more. Screw it, man. Put yourself together, you miserable piece of rubbish, I thought, getting up. I got into the sink. The water was already boiling. This is stupid. My job is minimum wage, nothing interesting, no stress. I'm neither junkie nor alcoholic, so what the hell? Have I drunk a lot yesterday? No, it was only one pint, and only one, because it smelled like someone put the juice of the oldest fish available into this. Seafood-flavored beer, goddammit, I should to mix the waitress with mud, but first, I fancy her, and second, I'm an immigrant, so I have to behave. So, no mixing for us, whether genetically or verbally. Seafood. Oh, now wait a mother bleeping second. It was a good gig. Boring week and the worst pint I've ever had in my life. I never liked drinking. What's the point of drinking alcohol? You lose money, you talk shit, you act like an idiot, and in the end you wake up and want to die, and even if you're more unlucky, you remember what bad have you done to have justice, to have moral hangover. The thing is, it was the fact a horrible week, and I just needed to hear something new. I had nothing to do, and in that particular pub, jazz is always good. They have the best jazz, the most beautiful waitresses, and the worst pints, it seems. Well, that particular night jazz was even better, and than the best, and I simply got late for the last bus. Good thing I lived nearby, a mile, maybe two. Sky was dark clean, and in the case of emergency, I always had my Norwegian super jacket. I do not have to rush. I have weekend free. My housemate is working for the weekend, has working weekend and night shifts. My family is far, far away. I was going slowly. People that were going back in the evolution cycle in their drinking, there were mostly students, guys, and girls aiming and filing at the taxi door in order to get on board. I never failed to board a taxi, really. I was passing disco clubs for all of these women that never will be mine, and even if I could have them, I probably wouldn't be interested, as I'm generally weird. Not to mention that life was complicated enough already, and it needed solution and not another complication. I was passing restaurants, takeaways, some packed, some less. Through the window, I spotted a woman sitting in the takeaway serving seafood-based stuff. She was lost in thoughts. Does she think same things like me all the time, or at least sometimes? Does she ask how long will it last, day after day, night after night, roundabout of days, quick getaways with harmful returns? Some counters, same counters, same cracks in the walls, same view on the street. I can always get away, get back, I am alone but free. What about her? Can she be happy in her tiny shop with consciousness that it is probably what she's going to do for the rest of her life? I wonder how on earth people can live and work in the same place for life. Do not think about this. Do not get pissed with the same view, same faces. I kept on walking. I passed the church. The bells of whatever they have inside
started to sing their catatonic song. I tried to count the matter out as I'm obsessive when it comes to music theory. I recall the song, I wish someone could play it at my funeral. It's a sad one about fading away and how life gets tasteless when you're getting old. Dang, I must be real old. I looked into dark, cloudless night sky. A lonely star was hanging over the horizon. It could have been Sirius or Venus. Who cares? I was never good at astronomy, but for some reason I always had a strong star drive or whatever there is. Only this bloody gravity was holding me back like a bow and chain, putting back together with one force after another. Okay, cheers.
Thank you so much. That was well worth the wait. Okay. I think we're out of readers now, aren't we? Everybody done? In which case, does anybody have any further announcements that they want to make? Joe?
Just a reminder that the Bristol Fantasy and SF Society meets in here next Monday, if anybody would like to come along and just, you know, have a pint and a chat and hang out.
Also a reminder that Pete Newman will be signing his debut novel, The Vagrant, at Forbidden Planet on the 30th? Yes, right.
Yeah, I've got a couple of copies of North by Southwest if you haven't already bought it. And we're doing a thing in the library, an evening with North Bristol writers on the 26th at 6:45. It's a Wednesday, yeah.
Any other events coming up? What's the next Fringe, Joe?
It would be the 18th of May, Bengali and Sophie Tellers.
And finally, don't forget to buy your BristolCon memberships before the 1st of May, or you will have to pay £5 more.
Anyone wants to be a panel at BristolCon, give us a shout, because, yeah, we're always up for having new and exciting panellists. So if you feel brave enough to do a panel, let me know when you pay your membership, and I will make sure that you're on the list of potential panellists.
And then we can all drive Meg crazy trying to fit everybody into the schedule. Brilliant. Yeah, the panel topics, I believe, were discussed at the weekend and will be up soon.
We talked about them on Saturday. We've got about 30 or 40 potential panel topics. So what will happen is, if you sign up as a panelist, you will get a list of potential panel topics, and you then choose the ones that you would like to see and the ones who would like to appear on, and then we will run the top 12 or 13 that are most popular. So you'll get a huge list, and we won't run all of them, but you get to pick what you're interested in.
And Age of Ultron opens on the 23rd. I hope you've all got your tickets. Anybody else? In which case, I think we're done for the night. We'll see you all in May. Thank you very much.